and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, historian and archaeologist Bob King on the history of homesteading in Alaska. Hosted by the Bureau of Land Management as part of their Fireside Chat Lecture Series, Bob King was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center in Anchorage on April 11th.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the BLM Campbell Creek Science Center. My name is Louisa Wolfline. I work here at the center, and one of the things I do is coordinate these talks. We are very happy you all came out tonight. Thank you so much. I love this time of year when we aren't putting down the blinds to keep the glare off the windows, but to actually keep light out from pouring into the room. It's just a wonderful time of year. The Bureau of Land Management operates this facility, and we are a land management agency within the Department of the Interior. And the BLM, as a multi-use agency, is managing for a host of land uses, resources, energy resources, biological resources, recreation, and cultural resources. And the fireside chats in general try to touch upon many of those different categories of the topics that we deal with as a land management agency. Tonight, obviously, we're focusing on cultural resources, and it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Bob King, who is the state archaeologist for the BLM in Alaska. Bob earned his undergraduate degrees in both anthropology and history from Washington State University. He also earned master's and doctoral degrees in anthropology from the University of Pennsylvania. And he specialized in his master's and doctoral in archaeology and ethnohistory. Tonight, as you all know, Bob is here to talk with us about homesteading. And in addition to his academic credentials on this topic, he also has some rather extensive personal experience in this subject. Many members of his family were homesteaders. His grandfather received a homestead in 1909 in Washington State, and Bob manages that homestead today. In addition, Bob came to work for BLM Alaska in the early 1980s when homesteading was still possible here. He witnessed the excitement and special circumstances of claims being filed in a form of homesteading that didn't end until October of 1986. He told me that ever since coming here, he's been fascinated to learn more about homesteading, how it worked here in Alaska, and was interested in meeting Alaskan homesteaders. And as we saw, there are a number of you here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Bob King to talk about homesteading.
I'm pleased to be here, and I thank you all for coming. And I'm pleased that everyone's here, and super pleased that we have some homesteaders here. We have Mr. Hal Post, who homesteaded, and we have Mary and Clyde Lovell and their family here also. And have I missed anybody else who homesteaded? But I really appreciate everybody's coming out for this. What I'd like to do tonight is give you sort of a whirlwind tour through homesteading as it happened nationally, and then also as it happened here in Alaska. And then we're going to drill down a little bit more into how it happened in our closer area here. So with that, let me get started. So I thought I'd just ask this question. So what brings us here tonight? Well, you might say it happened because of two presidents. And those two presidents were ones that were involved with signing important homestead legislation. The two presidents are shown here. It was Abraham Lincoln and William McKinley. And Lincoln was the president who signed the first piece of homestead legislation, which provided free land for the citizens of the United States and those that would like to become citizens. But that didn't apply to Alaska for a while, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But it took until William McKinley's term before homesteading became possible here in Alaska. And there's some sort of an eerie kind of coincidence going on. Abraham Lincoln signed the 1862 Homestead Act, and 3 years later he was assassinated. William McKinley signed the 1898 Homestead Act for Alaska, and 3 years later he was assassinated. That was something that dawned on me as I was dealing with these figures, but just a strange little twist of history. That's a representation on the left of what the actual Homestead Act looked like. It was just a common piece of legislation passed by the Congress, but not without a struggle, which I'll get into. But I thought it might be good to touch base because we're starting to forget what homesteading really was. And if you tried to find out what it was, you'd probably go to a dictionary or Wikipedia or something. And you would find that there's generally not fewer than three major definitions. One is just the commonplace definition of a homestead anywhere you want to live or where you go back to. At the end of the lecture tonight, I'm going back to my homestead, but I bought the place, so it's not quite the same. Number two, it's a idea in law. It's a place where it's the amount of property that an owner has that cannot be taken from them in bankruptcy. And number three, it's really what we're talking about this evening. It refers to 160 acres originally, that was the size, that were granted through legislation, the 1862 Homestead Act. And the purpose was to develop a farm. That was the original intent. And so it was a tract of public land that left the public domain and went into private ownership. Okay, the purpose of the Homestead Act, I wanted to touch base again because it sort of sets up the whole idea of homesteading. It was to allow people the ability to obtain free land. And it was for Americans and also for foreigners who would, by the time of receiving their homestead, they would have to become Americans. So it was a citizenship thing as well. And also, in the grander scheme of things, the broader thing was to provide economic opportunities and a way for people to improve their lives. And some did, and some didn't, as we'll find out. The original requirements of the Homestead Act, in 1862, it was pretty simple, and it did get changed. But it was basically this. You had to live on the land that you selected for 5 years, most of it. You did have allowances for time for vacations and medical and that sort of thing. But no absences longer than 6 months. Occupy a dwelling on the land. It had to be a habitable dwelling. A tent wouldn't count. Also, you had to perform agriculture on the land. The specific amount in the original act was not specified. Other requirements, you had to be at least 21 or the head of a household. And then also, you would those that served in the Army or Navy would obtain special rights later on, and single women could homestead. Now, this was quite remarkable because this came at a time long before women received the voting rights, and that was years, decades later. So this was quite far-reaching. Again, a citizen, or you had to obtain your citizenship by the time that you received your patent. Generally, that was you filed a declaration of intent to become a citizen. Also, because of the time when it was passed during the Civil War, there was a restriction that you could not get a homestead if you had borne arms against the United States. So that effectively shut out all of the residents of the Confederacy, which I guess by their definition, they were no longer subject to the laws of the United States anyway. So that was a difference. Here's what a homestead patent or certificate, as it's called, looked like. You could also call it a deed. And I brought an original one here, which you may later on this evening, if you'd like to come up. I brought some items for you to look at, including an original one from the 1880s, and I brought a replica one from 1988. In fact, they're 100 years apart. One's 1888 and one's 1988. And the 1988 one is the very last one that was patented in the entire United States. And it was to a man by the name of Kenneth Deardorff, and we'll hear more about him in a minute. But this was sort of a typical one from 1874. They didn't change in what they looked like for many decades. But that's what you eventually got from the federal government when you received and fulfilled the requirements for homesteading. It was mailed to you from the Washington, D.C. office of the General Land Office, which is the predecessor of the Bureau of Land Management. And the General Land Office, which existed from 1812 until 1846, and this marks its 200th anniversary, it oversaw the first homesteading and most of the homesteading in the lower 48. And then BLM had the majority, it oversaw the majority of the homesteading here in Alaska. And BLM was formed in 1946. And so most of our homesteads actually were after 1946 in Alaska. Now, just to kind of put the bookmarks, the book ends on the subject, the first and the last homesteader. The first one is shown below, or at least the man who is generally acknowledged to be the first. His name was Daniel Freeman, and he was a Civil War soldier. And he filed for a homestead just minutes after it was possible legally to file, which was January 1st, 1863. Even though the law was passed on May 20th, 1862, it didn't go into effect until January 1st of 63. And moments after it did, the land office, by a prior arrangement at Brownsville, Nebraska, which was serving the Beatrice area, opened the doors, and he was first in line. He was a Civil War soldier, had to get back to his unit, and so they allowed him to be first in line. And later on, he became sort of a professional first homesteader, as it became more of a prestigious thing in the later 1800s and early 1900s. He actually sought out some celebrity for his status as the first homesteader. But the trick in perhaps his not being the first homesteader goes back to the railroads of all things. Before the transcontinental railroads, there were no standardized times in towns, and towns pretty much observed the time that was, you know, if it looked like it was noon, then it was noon in that town. But if it, 100 miles to the west, well, the sun was in a different angle, and so they were observing noon at another time. Well, land offices which took these applications were in many different places, and so each land office had its first applicant, and several of them also opened on January 1st, 1863. So it's a bit uncertain who it was, but we're positive who the last one was. And that's Mr. Kenneth W. Deardorff, who homesteaded here in Alaska, receiving his patent on May the 5th of 1988. And he's the last person in America to receive an agricultural homestead, one that was intended to be a farm. And I point that out because I will come back to that later, because here in Alaska, we have some non-agricultural homesteads, which are an anomaly compared to the national homesteads. Lime Village was the area for Kenneth Deardorff, and southeast Nebraska for Daniel Freeman. Now, you might wonder, what's the bigger picture? Well, it might surprise you to hear that homesteading, although we think of as a Western phenomena, and it certainly was also in the southeast, Florida. You've heard of Homestead, Florida, south of Miami? Guess where that came from? There was a lot of homesteading there, even into the late 18th and early 20th centuries, late 19th and early 20th centuries. Every state in the light tan is a state where homesteading was allowed or where it occurred. And so you might think of, now, what's the deal with Texas? We kind of think of Texas as a Western state. So why isn't that a homestead state? And then there's a few other places on the map that are browned out. So what's the deal with them? And here's what the deal is. There was no homesteading in the original colonies because when they came in as states, they owned their land, as it were. There were three states derived from the original colonies. We kind of forget that Vermont came out of New Hampshire and that Maine came out of Massachusetts. And also West Virginia is more known as having come out of Virginia during the Civil War. There was also two states that were settled rather early, Kentucky and Tennessee, and then one state that came in as an independent republic and retained its homestead lands as internal state lands, and Texas, that's Texas. But there's even a little bit of an asterisk there that I don't add, because Texas, when it came in, it had land claims up into southern Wyoming and four other states. And in 1850, the United States government paid Texas, I think it was $10 million, to relinquish its claims. And so some of those lands became parts of other five states, and those were homesteaded. So it's a trick question of whether Texas was homesteaded or not. Plus, they also had their own homesteading program after they became a state. And then the final one is the Kingdom of Hawaii came in, and it had no public lands, no lands that were otherwise owned collectively by the United States. And I put on some statistics there that I maybe should have covered. It's actually unknown, surprisingly, the number of people that precisely claimed homesteads. And it's also presently unknown the exact number that got homesteads. And if you'd heard me talk a few years ago, I would have given you the precise number in Alaska, but now I can't. Because I know more about some of the records and the problems with the homestead records. Basically, it boils down to this. They started tracking homestead records pretty early, and there were some problems in some of the counts. And so there's probably no fewer than 1.6 million homesteads granted, and it's probably over 2 million. But in terms of people that applied and didn't get homesteads, it's probably well over 4 million. And of the successful ones anyway, 1.6, there's something like 93 million descendants. And in fact, the Lovell family right now is an example of with the children and all, there's descendants. So let me go back again and kind of restart and discuss the 1862 Homestead Act. As we know, passed by Abraham Lincoln, or signed into law by Abraham Lincoln in 1862, but it was not an easy thing. It had its own history, and it's part of this larger issue of what does the United States do with all the lands that it's acquiring? It's getting lands by different purchases, by wars, by the relinquishment of the original colonies. There was a compromise early in the history of the United States that the claims of Virginia, the claims of New York and Connecticut, all of those that were just kind of westward claims without any real boundaries, there was a decision that those would become the public lands. And it's that important thing that has created this sort of, that we all own it, that it's the lands that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management today, are those residual lands that started way back when, at the beginning of the nation, when we decided as a nation we wanted a set of common lands. But at the same token, we fought a revolution, and we fought other wars after that, 1812 and Indian Plains Wars and Civil Wars and everything else. And so the lands that were accumulated, those also became valuable assets for paying off war debts and also providing bounty lands or rewards for those soldiers that had served the country faithfully in those wars to help achieve independence or to win the war of the moment. Now, there was a history leading to the 1862 Homestead Act. There were people that supported it. It was much more supported in the northern states than it was in the southern states where slavery was in force. There was a feeling by the Southerners that if homesteading occurred as a national policy, that it would start drawing people off. And if those states or those territories were then free areas, then it would be a direct area where maybe their property, they considered the slaves, would leave. And so there was a great resistance to that. Not 100%, but by and large, the southern states were against it. So it was no coincidence that the homestead law didn't pass until the South was not part of the United States at that point. It had seceded from the Union. As early as the 1840s, there was interest to privatize land. There had been different land laws. It's an interesting history, the subject of land laws and how we came down to the Homestead Act, and I can't get into that, but just suffice it to say that there were attempts, particularly in the 1850s, to create homestead legislation, and there was one that actually passed in 1860, and it was vetoed by President Buchanan, and the reason he cited was he wasn't quite sure if it was legal to privatize lands for free. And then also, another perspective was it wasn't quite what was being asked for either. It was charging 25 cents an acre rather than being free. So there were problems with that initial legislation. The requirements, the law itself was pretty straightforward, and sometimes simplicity isn't what you want when you have difficult problems. And so some of the wording was imprecise, could be interpreted different ways. I mentioned already that cultivation was not strictly defined. There was actually one land office that was administering this soon after the Homestead Act was passed, and this was in Montana. And they supposedly viewed it as a person could either build a dwelling or cultivate the land. And there was actually some reason to see that as a valid interpretation until they started doing some amendments and some modifications on the laws, and that quickly started happening. And over the course of the period that the Homestead Act was in force, there was at least 40 amendments and additional laws that supplemented it. And there was actually more than that in terms of sometimes it was private legislation dealing with an individual and their problems with homesteading. But there's just an awful lot of homestead laws, and some are more important than others, and I will point out a few. I put a few more things on what plants could be counted. That kind of varied. And here in Alaska, being the last part of homesteading, we had a little bit more allowance. Probably what was allowed here at the very end would have been squinted at it originally, and that is planting grass crops, essentially. But here in Alaska, that became a marketable commodity. And so that was allowed here in Alaska. But grass was too similar, or at least was thought to be too similar to what was growing naturally in the lower 48, and so wouldn't count as a crop. So things did change. Now, how did people administer this law? As a bureaucrat myself, as an archaeologist, I'm always intrigued of how do you know how to do things right? Well, here's one way it occurred. Today we have regulations which implement laws. Those weren't quite what was happening in the earlier days of the Homestead Act. You had general instructions that came out that were called circulars that tried to explain exactly what was permissible under laws and how to administer laws. One of the things that I brought today, again off of eBay, was something, it's a 1887 set of circulars that explain to general land offices how to administer some of the laws. And so these were the things that were literally shipped out to the various land offices throughout the country. Sometimes they were in volumes, sometimes as individual paper flyers of a few pages. So what are some of the recent depictions of homesteading? Well, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman have helped, for sure. Their 1997 movie, Far and Away, was perhaps one of the most recent ones, and it focused on the Oklahoma land rush. But is that how it happened everywhere? No, actually not. And it didn't actually happen everywhere in Oklahoma that way either. It was just one of the many ways that homesteading occurred. And here, there's some pictures that relate to this episode, but what I've come to find out is that there are many different ways that America was homesteaded, and some of it, there's just not good books yet written on all the variations. These are some depictions that are kind of fun. Some of the handouts in the back are posters that depict some of the early 20th century postcard views of what homesteading was like, and I've used a few of those even for this, for my PowerPoint slides here. But what I want to point out here is that this was not Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise. These were the common people. And it was people that you and myself, they were minorities, women's. There were some Hispanic homesteaders. Their stories are barely told. Certainly African-American homesteaders, and we did have at least two here in Alaska that I'm quite aware of. And these are some statistics. 1913 was the peak year. Notice the number of acres. That's just a little under half of the size of the state of Indiana was doled out to as patents to homesteaders in the year 1913 alone. 1902, that was the year of the most homestead applications. And just to scoop myself a little bit, the total number of successful homesteads here in Alaska, probably not more than about 3,500. And so look at that, 1 year, now that's all of the homestead applications, and including a few here in Alaska, not many in 1902 though. So it was really something. I wanted to just show a few more of these kind of fun views. We can kind of see what may have been more typical for the lower 48 by looking here. you had some people that homesteaded in different kinds of houses. Here's some immigrants, African Americans, I mentioned this. Sometimes ethnic groups came as organized groups from Europe. There was a lot of advertising even in Europe to bring that the homestead law was in effect, and people came to the United States well aware of the ability to get homestead land. And sometimes the advertisements were not necessarily by the federal government, it was by steamship companies, because they would earn money by transporting people to the United States. And similarly, the Eastern Rail Lines, railroads would earn money by bringing people out to areas closer to where they could homestead. And also, once homesteads were established, they could make a lot of money by providing the needed transport of the crops that would be produced on those homesteads, plus supplies, bring supplies for the homesteaders. So again, what did some of the homesteads look like? Sod houses on the Great Plains in some areas, western Nebraska, for example, Kansas. You had them into the Dakotas, into Colorado, Oklahoma. But that wasn't the only place. Now, this is getting a little bit more like Alaska. For some of our early homesteads, there were some early log structure homesteads just north of Palmer. And these happened not to be Alaskan ones, but not so very different. The one up here is one from Washington State, and this one here is more likely somewhere in the closer to the mountains in Montana. A little hard to say on some of that stuff. Also, it was not, it was pretty common to have brought in lumber from lumber mills, particularly after the trains were available for transporting things. And you got dwellings kind of like this. You got one made of milled wood, and oftentimes they were tar paper covered. And then in the lower 48, they had to do more than that. in some places they were just too drafty, and so oftentimes they placed sod around them, and some actual cabins were sod themselves, but oftentimes sod and things were banked around them.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Bob King, historian and archaeologist with the Bureau of Land Management. His talk on the history of homesteading in Alaska was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center Fireside Chat on April 11th.
Now, how did homesteading kind of really end? Well, this was, you know, if you're a vampire, it takes maybe some several bullets and a stake and the fire and I don't know, whatever else. But this was certainly one of the silver bullets that was fired at it, because the Taylor Grazing Act was passed. And this was an act that recognized the fact that really either we were going to give away really all of the marginal lands and they would be going to, in larger quantities, to grazing interests more likely. And that was Canada's solution, by the way. They also had a form of a homestead act, and they eventually gave away their private lands and they became lands for the actual provinces. And so you don't have national lands of Canada now like you did. And Herbert Hoover in 1930 proposed that all of the public lands, including the BLM's lands of today, would be given to the states or territories in which they were located, and that would have ended the law. So there was a lot of debate by 1930 what to do with these lands that otherwise hadn't been given out in other forms or privatized in other ways or placed in other kinds of reserves or parks. Well, the solution was, by 1934, the law that settled it was the Taylor Grazing Act, and it authorized two withdrawals, or it resulted in two land withdrawals, which withdrew from homestead entry and other forms of settlement all of the lands in the lower 48 states that were managed as otherwise not withdrawn lands. There were some lands that were withdrawn in 1902 for reclamation projects, and under terms of those laws, those could be opened up later for homesteading. And so there was a little bit of lower 48 homesteading in those special areas, but 98% of the lands were effectively closed in the lower 48 for all forms of future homesteading after February of 1934. And so what was playing out in the lower 48 was the proving up and the final patenting of those claims. And as we saw earlier, in the 60s, the numbers were coming down to single digit by that time. Now, what was the second silver bullet in all of this was the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. And that's one that was passed at the time. It becomes sort of the organic act for the Bureau of Land Management. It was an act, among other things, that finally repealed all of the homestead laws, with one minor exception. We always have exceptions. But there was one minor exception. It wasn't exactly a homestead law. It was the 1877 Desert Land Act, which had some other terms to it. But in terms of sometimes its effect, it is sometimes sort of brought into the idea of the homestead era laws. But that one wasn't repealed and still remains on the books today, but no lands are presently classified for that type of action. Well, anyway, this was what sealed it, but it was recognized that here in Alaska, we started later and for homesteading, the law didn't apply here for a number of years, and there was still a lot of interest to homestead, or at least it was thought to be a lot of interest to homestead. But what happened after World War II, you had a lot of new things that were happening in general. You had other laws that were performing some of the functions of homesteading. That is to say that they were privatizing land, and probably a majority of the people that that wanted land were not really gung-ho to truly become farmers. There were exceptions, but many people wanted a place, at least here in Alaska, a place to call their own, a place to retreat, a place to live, but not necessarily a permanent spot to be continually farming, as difficult as it was to farm in most places here in Alaska. I mentioned that the reclamation homesteads, that refers to the Act of 1902 that I'll get into in just a moment. And then most post-World War II homesteading was done here in Alaska. I mentioned some new laws. Not too long after the Taylor Grazing Act was passed in 1938, what's referred to generally as the Small Tract Act was passed. And that allowed for specific sales, and sometimes those sales, that law was in effect here in the Anchorage area, as was homesteading, as was the non-agricultural form of homesteading. So a whole mix of things was available here in the Anchorage Basin. But under that 1938 law, there were at times actual weekly sales announced in the Anchorage paper of land available for purchase through the Small Tracts Act. And it did allow a leasing provision as well, but the leasing provision allowed you to petition or to ask for it to be sold to you. It was sort of like a trial sale almost. It came out to be that way. And that also was repealed by the 1976 legislation that has the acronym of FLTMA. Post-Reclamation Act, I mentioned that a little bit earlier, where certain areas had been withdrawn under a special act in 1902 that was, it was an act that withdrew areas where it was pretty much straightforward that no individual could afford to reclaim those lands. It had to be major dam projects, major irrigation canals, and so that's what happened in the very last areas. This map shows a few of these last post-1945 places where there were reclamation homesteads. And the last one that I'm aware of would be claims in the mid-1960s in the largest one of all of the post-World War II areas, and that was the Columbia Basin Project of Washington. And that's where Columbia River water was brought into parts of Grant and Franklin counties and the drier, arid regions there. But by that time, things were getting still a little bit strange. It wasn't exactly homesteading, even as it occurred in the earlier reclamation areas. They were starting to sell some of the parcels in those homestead areas. So there's hardly anything you can say about it homesteading that doesn't have some exceptions to it. That's what I have found out, sometimes the hard way. Now, finally, a little bit more focused on Alaska itself. The key, if you're going to do agriculture here in Alaska and to get a true agricultural homestead, one of the things that you would need is an area where you can grow crops. And this is one view of where you can rather successfully, but not entirely successfully, farm. And so you see, there's not much that's above the Arctic Circle, and as you go that high, you're getting into seasonal issues of short growing seasons. But that's probably a little more generous than what homesteading really happened. And just to review again why we didn't have much homesteading initially, we had to have a population come up. And that was the gold rush, and those that first came up, they weren't exactly trying to raise potatoes and everything else. They were after the gold. And also, gold mining was oftentimes transitory. They went from one strike to the other, and so they weren't necessarily interested to settle down. But that said, there were some people that did want to actually own facilities, because there were some people that were building infrastructure, the people with the early roadhouses and that sort of thing. They wanted to get a way to own land, and there weren't hardly any ways available to own land. And so this piece of legislation that occurred in 1898 that brought homesteading to Alaska, it was a big, broad sack of laws that allowed other kinds of things to happen. It also involved trade and manufacture site legislation. That was extended to Alaska at the same time. It was section 7 or 5 in the 1898 Act. And the 1898 Act itself was amended here in Alaska. And depending on what part of the Act was amended, it really told you what the people had in mind, even if they didn't quite tell you originally. The 1898 Act also provided for the railroads to get ownership to the land, because obviously they would want that if they're going to build railroads. It was fishing companies that were among the first homesteaders in Alaska, which is just a little bit counterintuitive. Now, as mysterious as the first homesteader is, why not another mystery? Who was the first person to actually earn a homestead as it was envisioned at the time of Lincoln? That is to say, to actually cultivate the land. This might be the person. Don't really know. And the person, actually, it wouldn't be Brown. Lawson Garrison assigned it to him. And so this person may have gotten the first agricultural homestead, but he probably didn't do the agriculture on it. And whether Lawson Garrison did the actual agriculture on it, not sure. So there's some things to figure out. As long as I've studied this, it becomes more curious all the time. Now, just like the lower 48, there was major homestead legislation changes. I covered some of those. There's many I didn't cover. But there were some major ones just for Alaska that occurred. And these are the four major ones. Interestingly, before the Kincaid Act, and you remember that was the one that increased the size of homesteads in western Nebraska in 1904 to four times the standard 160 acres, we had in Alaska, before anybody else, we had 320 acre homesteads allowed. And that was from 1903 until 1916. And then it was in 1916, they changed it down to 160 acres again. And one of the reasons, I read some reports by some of the government officials at the time, and the 320 acre homesteads were kind of glomming on to entire small valleys. And that was counterproductive to the idea of bringing more people to Alaska. So it was better to at least bring them down to 160 acre homesteads, because in theory you could get twice as many people to settle in an area. And that was one of the reasons why homesteading was favored in Alaska, was for settlement. And perhaps for many people the cultivation was secondary. It was a mechanism to get a land in Alaska for many people. Again, 1918, some more amendments. The way it worked in the lower 48 was that you couldn't actually file for a homestead application until the land was surveyed. And they did some adjustment of that for here in Alaska. Also, 1918, the standard was that the government would survey it for free, but you were allowed under some amendments to actually pay for your own survey if you wanted to get it faster for whatever reason. Also, here it had been standard to have a rectangular survey that would actually be plotted within the surveys that were done by the federal government. But in 1926, that was waived for Alaska, and you actually could have homesteads that followed natural topography. Creek boundaries could be the homesteads, and that was unusual for us. 1912, the three-year homestead, I mentioned that applied to us. And in 54, it was kind of interesting, they said that all homesteads had to be perfected only under terms of the 1912 Act. And the 1912 Act had added a few more things that were required, but it was kind of interesting. So we were able to homestead under two forms of the 1912 Act, so it only gets more complicated. And then the requirement, the basic requirement had always been that from the 1890s, that 1/8 of the homestead had to be cultivated to receive it. But under certain circumstances, particularly here in Alaska, it was possible at times to get it with 1/16 or with no cultivation at all under certain circumstances, which again was a far cry from how it started. But with all of the amending for Alaska, there were still some that felt it wasn't quite hitting the stride of what we needed in Alaska to privatize land, and they wanted even some alternatives for homesteading in Alaska. And two laws were passed, 1927 and 1934, that amended a section of the 1898 Homestead Act for Alaska. But you remember that one was a mixed bag where it brought in other things. It amended the portion of the act where it was authorizing trade and manufacture sites. But it went on to call that some of those by 1934 were designated for 5-acre homes sites, as they became called, but they were called legally in the law as homesteads. So we ended up with another terminology, another use of the term homestead here in Alaska. And so it also came to apply to a form of homesteading, if you want to call it that, which required no cultivation, but the trade-off was you could only get 5 acres, and you didn't get it for free. You had to pay the princely sum of $2.50 per acre. But you still had some of the basic requirements. You had to live on the land for the 3 years, substantially for 7 months, and you also had to have a habitable dwelling. You couldn't live in your a car body that was dragged on your property. As I saw when I was in the 80s and I was on some of those claims. Some of them were rather picturesque, shall we say. So anyway, this, as these laws accumulated for Alaska and changed, and even this new form of homesteading, and also the Small Tracts Act, and all these other things, there were now a larger bag, a larger toolkit for privatizing land in Alaska. And so finally, you started to have more and more land being privatized in Alaska. And a lot of it was indeed after the war, and just after the war, BLM was emerging as it was arguably a reorganization of wartime agencies led to the creation of BLM. And so most of the homesteading in Alaska and all of the other privatization laws that were used to privatize lands in Alaska were administered by the Bureau of Land Management. And so you started getting privatized lands in places where definitely you couldn't homestead, at least not reasonably homestead, not what you would think. So there were, I mentioned that there were a few other ways. The trade manufacturer laws had actually been passed for Alaska as early as 1891, but they didn't seem to be well thought out. There was a little bit larger than necessary, and so finally they did sort of click in 1898. And I might say that a lot of, I won't say a lot, but some of the so-called homesteads of early Alaska, if you really look at them closely and look at how the land was privatized, they're not technically patented under homestead legislation. They may be under trade and manufacture legislation. For example, Captain William Moore's homestead at Skagway, Alaska, he settled there in 1888. And it was a tortuous situation for him, but when he finally got some land, his homestead was under the trade and manufacture laws. And so you'll find that to be the case, and there's actually a book that's been written, a woman who lived a homestead-like existence quite late, she was actually received her land as a trade and manufacture site. I mentioned the Small Tract Act, as a way, and this was also used widely in the Copper River area, the area around Glen Allen and south. That was very applicable there. And then also, I mentioned that there was Indian homesteading. Well, a form of Indian homesteading came to Alaska in the form of the 1906 Native Allotment Act. And if you read that piece of legislation, it talks about homesteading right there. And the terms, it was for 160 acres, so it was really modeled after homestead legislation, and it was our version, and a reasonably successful version because of the number of parcels eventually claimed and being patented. And those are the statistics. There's the number of native allotments is that are yet to be patented and adjudicated are pretty much getting pretty low now for the numbers. The Indian Allotment Act from the lower 48, there were four that were used up here. There was one that was here in the Anchorage Basin under Indian homestead legislation passed in the 1880s, was used here. So there was a little bit of everything that happened here in Alaska. And then most recently, arguably the last piece of homestead legislation, even though homesteading is not possible, was an amendment to the Native Allotment Act that occurred in 1998 that allowed for certain Alaskan natives who were tied up in the last years of homesteading under the Native Allotment Act in that twilight in 1971, that they were in Vietnam. And so it was seen that they didn't get a fair chance. And so homesteading was allowed for them for a certain time period, which has now been cut off. And you can see that 1,064 parcels were selected, and not all were patented, and some are still pending. And I don't think that those are quite patented yet. So one could think of a sort of a stepson or a connected form of homesteading is still going on in Alaska. I mentioned the Federal Land Policy Act ended homesteading the lower 40, but continued it here in Alaska till 86. And that's just what the law looked like. It's quite a thick law. And now, just a quick look at Alaska's and Anchorage's homesteading story. Here's a picture of Anchorage in the 1930s when it was not the largest population area of Alaska. And that was Fairbanks for more than the history of the state. And so this was puny little Anchorage at that time period. And you'll notice all this vacant land down here, which we now have high rises on, that was nice forested areas and that was available for homesteading. But many people never thought that that would amount to anything and so didn't even try. The official privatization of land, with a slight exception, of course, was our 1915 sale of tracts by the federal government, and that's pretty well known for here in Anchorage. But I say exception because there actually were a few homesteaders that came to the region before there was an Anchorage, and these are some of the names. Tom Jeter, not quite sure about him because he sold out early, but Jack Brown and his wife became pretty well-known people here in town. This is the Jeter cabin, and that's kind of the story on that. It was not patented. It was lost in a court fight. The Whitneys, they came in, and some of the homesteads, and theirs was one of them here in the Anchorage area, was later on the area where it became the military bases. And there was actually a condemnation process that the homesteaders there were forced to sell their homesteads, some very not willingly, and so they were displaced. Also, here's Jack and Nellie Brown first settled on Ship Creek, 1912, and they were in Whitney's original cabin. They stayed around longer, and there's a book written on their lives, and it tells a little bit about their homesteading experience. This is a picture of what their homestead looked like, and this also is one that was taken for military lands during the run-up to the Second World War. And this is an area where, these are all private lands now for the military. Now, what's kind of interesting, and which starts to get back to one reason that I'm interested, is that, believe it or not, homesteads, some remains are now archaeological ruins and have been studied as such and have been documented as such. And the Brown's Cabin is one of those that's actually been surveyed by archaeologists to find features of it, and there may have been some excavation on it too. And that's in part because it's federal land, and there is a proactive emphasis to try to understand what cultural resources, and that's a more general term for archaeological and historical resources, what of those are on federal land and what should be managed as significant for the benefit of the public. Also, just as recent homesteading, this is a picture of Alaska even into the post-World War II period, and you'll still see that there's an awful lot of the Anchorage Basin that is still virgin land that has hardly been touched. So there was still homesteading here. The last slivers, I think, were diminishing by the very late 50s and early 60s. There were a few little slivers over in the Sand Lake area that could be homesteaded at that time. But more typically, some of our roads now bear the name of homesteaders. Clatt Road, here's the Clatt Homestead. They began homesteading in 47. And 18 miles, it was not easy to get to their homestead. They had a corduroy road through all this swampy land that now has, it's getting paved over, and now we're sometimes reaping the benefits of roads that still leach into the swamps. The D'Arman Road, Harold D'Arman and his wife June, I believe that they celebrated their 61st wedding anniversary. I clipped it out of the paper in 2008, and I think that they're now moving to their 65th wedding anniversary. And they raised agricultural, and they also had farms, and I understand that some of their neighbors were not overly excited by the odors from their hog farm. There were homesteaders also, Eagle River all around here, north of Palmer, north of Wasilla, in those areas. I was at a, this was a representative picture of some living homesteaders, except we've got the better things here. We've got some real living homesteaders here with us tonight. But this is just an example. There are a lot of living homesteaders, although the number's decreasing. The youngest living homesteader was born in 1954. So we still have a few homesteaders that have not yet hit their 60th birthday. So with that, let me end my talk.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with historian and archaeologist for the Bureau of Land Management, Bob King. Hosted by the BLM, Mr. King's talk on the history of homesteading in Alaska was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center Fireside Chat on April 11, 2012, and edited for radio broadcast on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.